Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for January 3, 2008. I haven't made that mistake yet, but I haven't had many opportunities to. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two interviews up for tonight. First, about 6 or 7 minutes, we'll be speaking with Glenn Ford, who is the co-editor of the Black Agenda Report, about Obama mania and the state of black politics, the state of American politics, and the state of the world. Glenn Ford, a very sharp, thoughtful, and lively fellow, co-editor of one of the founders of the original Black Commentator. Now he's moved on to the Black Agenda Report. So we'll hear from him in a little bit. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Max Froud-Wolf, who is a journalist, economic consultant, and we'll be talking about the whole array of problems that we could call the current crisis, the housing bust, the mortgage meltdown, the derivatives dilemma, all these things. I could come up with a whole set of alliterations, but I'll stop there. And before we get to talk to Glenn Ford, just some observations on the current economic conjuncture, as they say over at New Left Review. The economic question of the moment is probably whether the financial crisis that broke out last summer, itself a byproduct of the bursting of the housing bubble, is about to tip the U.S. economy into recession. I realize that I keep throwing this word around without ever defining it, which may be a mistake. So before proceeding, I should say that a recession is a period of generally declining economic activity. That's what the textbooks say, which means that employment and income decline, businesses fail in large numbers, and unemployment rises. Governments also typically run short of cash and have to cut services in a recession. It's like a depression, only shorter and milder. Or as someone once put it, a recession is when your neighbor loses a job, a depression is when you do. In some sense, whether this is a recession or not is an academic matter. Recessions come and go. We've had 11 of them since the end of World War II. On average, they last a little less than a year. Expansions, when employment and incomes are rising, new businesses are opening and existing ones are expanding, and governments are relatively flush with cash, are far more common than contractions. The average expansion lasts almost 5 years, in fact. Since the long, deep recessions of the early 1980s, the expansions have gotten longer and the recessions have gotten shorter than they were in the 1950s and 1960s. But whether we're in recession or expansion, some things are persistently true. Poverty declines in expansion but never goes away, and the same with inequality. Class, gender, and racial disparities may lessen in expansion, but they too never go away. But not always. In the expansions of the 1980s and the 2000s, that was the one that began in late 2001, inequality has gotten worse as the rich do much better than the poor. It is true that the poor and the working class people generally do better when the economy is expanding, but not always. In any case, it's quite possible that the U.S. economy is now in or near recession. This is very unusual in an election year. The so-called political business cycle is one of the most reliable rhythms in the American political economy. A president usually accepts or even engineers a recession in the first year or two of his term, and then hopes or engineers for an expansion in the third and fourth years. If he's an incumbent, an expanding economy greases his reelection. If he's a lame duck, it makes things nicer for his party. Exceptions are Jimmy Carter, who faced a recession early in 1980 and was retired that November, and quite possibly George W. Bush, whose party already has enough trouble on its hands without the unemployment lines lengthening when spring turns into summer. But to return to my original point about whether this is a recession or not being an academic question, my suspicion is that the U.S. economy is entering a period of structural and not merely cyclical troubles. When the stock bubble burst in 2000, one could have expected some severe economic fallout that never really materialized. A major reason for this was that the housing boom stepped in and offset the dead weight of collapsing stock prices and gloomy sentiments, especially among the capitalist class. And stock ownership is very concentrated among the rich, so they bore the brunt of the downturn in stocks. But housing is the major financial asset of the middle classes, a vague term that I apologize for using, but this is just a brief radio commentary, so indulge me. The downturn in housing is hitting scores of millions in the pocketbook, not to mention the millions who are at risk of foreclosure and eviction. The housing bubble made people feel richer and allowed many people to borrow money on easy terms, not just to buy houses, but also to spend on things. That borrowing offset the weak growth in jobs and income that have characterized this expansion, but this expansion really has never felt all that good to lots of us. So now people are more dependent than ever on their labor incomes, and the job market is giving every sign of slowing down. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, we get the monthly employment report for December. In a normal month, and by normal I mean based on long-term historical averages, we might expect something like 250,000 new jobs. I'm guessing we'll be lucky to see a quarter or a third that many. The unemployment rate is likely to drift higher as well. I'll have more to say about the job market next week after I've had a chance to digest that report, but for now, the labor market is looking weak and getting weaker. And a real recession would see job losses, and I don't think we're there yet. But we could be there in another month or three. And given the deep indebtedness of many U.S. households, that could present some serious problems. More on all this later in the program. And let's take a little musical break and come back with Glenn Ford.
When I grow up, gonna be a star. Gonna sing my songs and play my guitar. I'm ready. Gonna change the world, gonna turn the page. Gonna say what I feel, let out this rage. Get ready. We're going down, down the streets below. Gonna sing the songs of the streets again. Gonna know me on my feet again.
And that a bit of I Wasn't Born to Follow from an older and mellower Social Distortion. Social Distortion, one of the leading lights of 80s hardcore punk, but that came out in 2004. And all right, we're now joined on the line by Glenn Ford, who is the co-editor of the Black Agenda Report, which is on the web at blackagendareport.com, all one word. Welcome, Glenn.
Ah, it's great to be here, Doug.
So it does seem like maybe Iowa, much of the liberal left, are in the grip of Obamamania, and you at the Black Agenda Report are dissenters. What's your problem with Barack Obama?
Barack Obama is a fraudulent peace candidate, and he's not a member of that liberal left you speak of, no matter how you define it. It's quite clear that Barack Obama is a corporate candidate. His pronouncements on foreign policy, and especially when those words are directed towards the Council on Foreign Relations and its branch in Chicago, show him to be in many ways a more fundamental imperialist even than Hillary Clinton, who otherwise is basically his political twin. I cannot understand, well, I think I understand, but it makes no sense on its face that folks who call themselves something like that liberal left that you're talking about could possibly support a candidate that wants 100,000 new, that is additional, soldiers and Marines for the U.S. Armed Forces while claiming to be a peace candidate. What are 100,000 new U.S. troops needed for in the world? That boggles the imagination.
Well, we're forces of peace and justice in the world, aren't we?
I suppose they are. They're going to put on blue helmets, I guess, and put flowers in their guns. So he is a fraudulent peace candidate, and he is black, but he is not the pro-black candidate. All of the signals that he sends, every single one of them, is directed towards a larger white audience. To make it understood that he is a safe candidate who believes that paying too much attention to racial issues is passé and possibly destructive, who has said that black folks have reached 90% of the way towards equality. That is a ridiculous statistically totally unsubstantiated statement. There is no basis, in fact, to say 90%. There is no economic or other index that shows anything like equality between blacks and whites, certainly not between the masses of blacks and the masses of whites. Black income has never exceeded 65% of white median income. And in fact, that gap is widening, that the percentage is dropping. Black wealth remains about one-tenth of white median household wealth. And to reach even 50% would take, at the rate of narrowing the gap that is as it is occurring now, would take several centuries to achieve even 50%. There is nothing to his statement, and I submit that if a white candidate had been saying such ridiculous things, such as blacks have reached 90% of equality with whites in the United States, there would be an absolute uproar throughout every political echelon of the black community. But because this comes out of a black man's mouth, it's just accepted. It's not challenged. The purpose of the statement, of course, is to make whites feel that very soon, very, very soon, possibly next January when he takes office, they can forget about the race problem because, hey, blacks are almost there. They have their president now. It actually won't be the black folks' president. And therefore, it's a lot closer than 90. No. Barack Obama implies that the vote for him would add that necessary 10%, and it's all over in terms of race in the United States.
I want to come back to many of the things you brought up, but let's start with his fraudulence as a peace candidate. A lot of people will give him credit for that. You at the Black Agenda Report have investigated his claims to have been opposed to the Iraq War from the beginning and found them somewhat seriously wanting. So give us the rundown on that.
Well, what Bruce Dixon and I found in 2003, in the summer of 2003, that his anti-war speech in Chicago, the one that was celebrated as if it was a five-year hallmark in not only his career but in American history, that soon after making that speech, he took it off of his website. We discovered that, and that's a very, very significant thing to do. He claimed that, well, you know, websites are always updated, but they're selectively updated. And what it meant was that by 2003, he wasn't bragging about that. In fact,
so he wanted to sweep it under the rug.
He wanted to sweep it under the rug because by the time his candidacy became much more serious and viable, well, the drumbeat was actually on. The war was actually on. And public opinion, not black public opinion, but general public opinion in the United States was doing its knee-jerk thing and going along with the commander-in-chief. And so later in 2003, he tells the New York Times that he doesn't know how he would have voted in 2002 if he had been a senator. Now, as the war becomes less and less popular, especially among white folks, it's always been unpopular among blacks, then he brings out that speech.
He found something under the rug after all.
That's his trump card, so he slams it on the table. But he was not as wedded to that speech after the war began as he claims to have been. And in fact, his behavior as a U.S. senator shows him to be no different than Hillary Clinton. He just doesn't have to apologize for the vote because he wasn't there.
Now, I think you also found that he was identified by the centrist, the center-right Democrats of the DLC, co-founder Bill Clinton, that he was identified as one of the 100 rising stars in the party?
Oh, yeah. Now, that was the reason that Bruce Dixon and I made contact with Obama. Bruce, by the way, had worked with Obama on voter registration in Chicago 8 years previously, 92. We were prompted to initiate an exchange, in fact, a month-long exchange with him, because his name showed up as a member of the Democratic Leadership Council, or rather their affiliate New Democrats. And that was quite upsetting, because I know that most people use that word centrist Democrats. They're the right-wing corporate money bag of the party. There's nothing center about them if we're talking about Democratic politics. And so we called him on that, and he claimed that he didn't know he was on that list. That's kind of ridiculous. And then we went on to put him to a bright lines test to see if he should or should not be in the DLC. We don't accept that he didn't know that he was on that list. By the way, later on in the campaign, he showed up on that DLC list again. If he's not in the DLC, he's done everything possible to show that he's with them in spirit.
When you're on that list, the campaign checks are far more forthcoming than if you're not on that list, aren't they?
Well, that is the whole point, because the DLC is the money bag for corporate America within the Democratic Party. The DLC vets the Democrats who will get corporate support, and those who pass the corporate test then will find much bigger checks and more of them in their campaign coffers.
Now, despite the obvious differences of complexion and gender, do you see him being significantly different from Hillary Clinton?
No. We've always referred to him as her political twin. And that's one of the reasons, besides the usual corporate media filter, which dumbs down and de-issues everything, but that's one of the reasons this has been such an issueless primary season. It concentrates on differences in personality, et cetera, because there is really not a dime's worth of difference between those two. John Edwards, of the top tier, has differentiated himself with his offensive against corporate greed and such, but there's no such thing between Hillary and Obama. And in fact, Obama has gone out of his way repeatedly to go before corporate audiences and praise the free American free enterprise system as the genius of America, and even to assure corporate captains that what's wrong is America has not asked those corporate forces for its help in solving the problems. That's a crazy statement, because the corporate powers are the powers that be, and nobody's asking the powers that be to let them be. It makes no sense at all, except when you understand that he is a corporate candidate. That's why he's raised more money than Hillary Clinton, who is also a corporate candidate. They don't give their money away for nothing.
Yeah, there was a piece in the Financial Times several months ago about the hedge funds, in many of which are based in Greenwich, Connecticut. I quoted somebody in there saying, all of Greenwich, meaning all of the hedge fund industry, is behind Obama. So I don't know whether they see him as some sort of rising growth stock or something, but he certainly appeals to the hot money up in Greenwich.
They see him as someone who will not upset their luxury pleasure boat. And he's given them every reason to believe that. And in fact, one of his first votes upon arriving in the Senate was to vote for so-called tort reform. That is a measure that would restrict citizen access to the federal courts.
He voted for that.
Oh, yes, he voted for that. And this is,
well, that's usually identified as a very Republican issue. That's not merely a conservative.
Oh, it was a Republican bill.
Yeah.
And he went along with it quite significantly. His colleague, the senior senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, voted against it, and there have been a number of occasions in which Dick Durbin has voted to the left, if we can phrase it that way, of Barack Obama. Barack Obama is to the right of the white senator from Illinois. Now, when people say, well, you know, he has to vote this way because this is the constituency and you don't want him to commit political suicide. Dick Durbin doesn't commit political suicide by voting against measures that are shaped by corporations. But Obama is given a free pass for doing the same thing. Obama has voted on the other side of Dick Durbin regarding the bankruptcy bills. There were several procedural bills that many of us cannot understand, but the best way to analyze those is, well, who's voting which way on these two or three procedural...
So he voted with the credit card industry.
That's right.
Wow.
And Dick Durbin found it. It was not political suicide in Illinois for him to vote against it. So we see that this guy is a fraud. And what we've been talking about here, of course, is he a fraud on basic Democratic Party terms? And that's very, very clear. But that's not why we're getting so upset about him and slap him every time he acts wrong. We at BlackAgendaReport.com see Barack Obama as a clear and present danger to the coherence of black politics. And we see the evidence every day.
I want to come back to this point, but I want to tell the audience that they're listening to Glenn Ford, who is the co-editor of the Black Agenda Report, which you can find on the web at blackagendareport.com. And you've got a piece just up yesterday, I guess, on Barack Obama. So anybody wants to check it out, please do. And support blackagendareport.com, which is a crucial truth-telling forum on the World Wide Web. And, okay, let's get back to that point. What does the popularity of Barack Obama tell you about the state of black politics in America now?
Barack Obama plugs into an ancient current in black politics, and that is, and it stems from Jim Crow segregation and, of course, previous to that, slavery. Barack Obama seems to fulfill a dream, an ancient one in black America, of having the ultimate black faces in high places. And it's quite understandable until the death of Jim Crow, which was, I was a young adult at that time, the white society at large was arrayed against every black aspiration. And therefore, any black person who rose to any kind of status through any means at all, that was seen as a victory for the whole, a collective victory of black folks. Then, of course, Jim Crow died and folk got the vote. And politics in black communities became politics between black folks. But the mentality of Jim Crow, of seeking just black faces in high places and not evaluating them on their performance and accountability to black people, still remains 40 years later. So that's a deep current. And it's not Obama's fault that it's there, but he benefits from it. That's the general thing. However, now with the nation consumed and involved in a campaign with a black figure at the center of it, that kind of those chickens are coming home to roost. And what we've discovered is the paralyzing effect of the Obama candidacy on black politics. And I have a little anecdote that I'd like to tell you that I think sums it up entirely.
Please do.
Okay. About 4 weeks ago, I was teamed up on Ron Daniels' show on WBAI with Charles Barron, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with him. He's a former Black Panther city councilman, quite progressive by any measurement, and one of my favorite politicians because he's a black electoral official who is also a political activist. So to me, he's a kind of model of what political folks should be if they seek office. Councilman Barron was on the show with me to announce that he had just endorsed Barack Obama for president. Ron Daniels knew our position on that. So I proceeded to outline what we have just talked about on your show, point by point, to say how can you support a person who obviously is on the other side of the political line from you? And he couldn't answer any of it. There was no coherent response. And finally, after about 10 or 15 minutes of this back and forth, which actually turned into a debate, he finally says, "I just want to give the brother a shot." And that was it. That's summed it up. It was pitiful, it was inadequate, but it really was accurate in terms of Barack Obama's knee-jerk support among black folks in general, and more critically, among activists, progressives, lifelong activists and progressives who damn sure should know better.
Well, white leftists like me dependent upon the black portion of the population to provide a reliable base of social democratic and anti-imperialist policies. You guys are letting us down here.
Absolutely. And that is why it is so important to understand that this is not just an intra-black affair. That is very important to those of us who are black and care first and foremost about the health of the black polity. But if the black polity descends into incoherence, and this is already happening, and Barack Obama has not yet won a primary, but it's already underway. If committed lifelong activists like Charles Barron can be paralyzed, put into a kind of comatose stupor, just by the presence of this corporate-funded black candidate, then we are in real trouble. And if the black polity becomes fractured or just paralyzed, then there really is no hope for anything resembling a progressive movement in the United States.
Well, it sounds in many ways like you're describing what is typical American ethnic politics. I mean, black Americans have been shaped by this country. They are Americans, so maybe they're just following a long tradition of this kind of politics. And
if that were so, then people like Charles Barron would not have to say, "I just want to give the brother a shot," when he's quite intelligent enough to know that brother is not on his side.
We've only got a minute left, but tell us the way out of this.
Out of this, that is extremely difficult, and there is no simple answer except the most obvious one, the basic one, the hardest one, and that is we need to form a people's movement. And when I say we, I mean specifically black people. What we have now is an array of media leaders, which is really the subject of our current article in Black Agenda Report. These are people who do no organizing. Even if they did previously, they don't do so anymore. They are leaders because they have slots in media, or they're called upon by corporate media in order to evaluate and analyze and package what's happening in black America. But they are leaders no more, if they ever were. Barack Obama is quite similar, phenomenon to them, in that nobody knew about him in 2003 if they didn't live in Chicago. Bruce Dixon only knew about him because, well, he'd lived in Chicago and worked with him. And all of a sudden he emerges full-blown as a national celebrity because corporate America found him not only acceptable but an attractive politician. So that's the Obama phenomenon, but it's occurring all throughout black America. Don't have leaders anymore, or rather our real leadership, community organizations at the grassroots, get no play, get no exposure, and our own people don't know who they are. This symbiosis that once occurred between black journalism, especially on radio, and black movement, whose activities were covered by black radio news people, that has been broken, and the decline, The ongoing crisis in black leadership can be traced to that moment in history.
I'm afraid we have to end it there. Thanks for joining us, Glenn Ford, and I can't recommend too highly the Black Agenda Report. You and your colleague Bruce Dixon and your stable of contributors are doing a fine job trying to reverse these gloomy trends. So check out blackagendareport.com. Let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener-supported and non-commercial.
And this is WBAI, which is not only at 99.5 on your FM dial in the New York area, but also on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break while I go out and get Max Fraud Wolf. And that the Fugue, number 6 in D minor from the Well-Tempered Clavier, book 2 by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Glenn Gould. And we're now joined in the studio by Max Frodwolf, who is an economist, economic consultant, journalist, frequent writer on the Huffington Post, and also, what's a Global Macro Report, right?
Global Macroscope, Asia Times, Prudent Bear.
Okay. And now on Behind the News. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, although we don't know how happy the New Year is going to be for the American economy. It doesn't look like it's getting off to a real champagne fizzy start, does it?
Not at all.
Well, I don't know if you heard my opening comments, but my view of things is that after the stock bubble burst in 2000, 2001, we had what seemed like a mild recession, a very strange recovery, but it was a recovery and then an expansion. But it was really helped along by the housing bubble. And that kind of stimulus, I think, papered over some really serious underlying problems that never came to the fore. Now, that bubble has burst, and these problems are staring us in the face. What do you think of that analysis?
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to phrase it any better myself. I think we'd be in 100% agreement on that. I think we've been living on bubbles one after another, many of which originate in the credit creation and the central banking, probably since the late 1990s. So even the last few years of the internet telecom bubble there from maybe 98 to 2000, 2001, when that burst, was even a bit of product of international banking policy and our gain from the loss from the East Asian financial collapse, which I think set up both the housing bubble and the last two or three years of the kind of crack-up top boom of the dot-com bubble, for lack of a better term. So I would agree completely, and I think we've gone bubble to bubble, and now we're all left waiting, trying to imagine a bubble big enough to paper over the disaster that has become the U.S. housing bubble.
Well, we can even take it back. We had the leveraging mania of the 80s. That bubble burst, and we had the problems of the early 90s, which Alan Greenspan solved by driving down interest rates. Then we had a stock bubble. So we've had serial bubbles for as long as I've been in this game of writing and thinking about the economy.
You could always use the combination Donald Trump private equity top of the market indicators. So when Donald Trump becomes popular again, you know the boom is almost over, because it's a signifier of the gross excesses of the crack-up wealth worship. And when private equity does a number of deals at valuations that are simply absurd, then the combination Donald Trump new fashion line and private equity top tells us that the bubble has reached an unsustainable level and is now about as good of an investment as Donald Trump's hair.
But also when Steve Schwarzman went public and sold Blackstone stock to the public, that was almost, you know, there's a saying in Wall Street, they don't ring a bell at the top, but that sounded like a pretty loud bell ringing to me.
Well, if you believe that these guys know how to value companies and know how to make money, then they're only going to sell you shares in their company when it absolutely could not go anywhere but down. And that's exactly what Blackstone stock has done. Unfortunately for its employees, some of which, off the record, no names named, are friends of mine. And they were pretty aggressive with getting their employees to buy those shares at full price, unlike the management, which got awards for free. And some of those employees are not so happy with that purchase. And of course, Nora are the various investors, including the Chinese official investors, who made multi-billion dollar bets on something that's gone one way and it wasn't up.
Well, okay, let's go back a little bit. The housing bubble peaked, late 2005, maybe early 2006, and gradually lost air. And then the mortgage market really hit a wall, last summer, I guess. So,
I mean,
how far along this process do you think we are now?
I would say best case scenario, we're a third of the way through and the bottom is still in the future, not the past. I think the mortgage market, I would agree with your dating. I think the mortgage market really began to show severe warning signs by late 05, early 06. But there was an absolute public no-go on discussion of the problem in the mortgage markets until July of 2007. So until September, maybe, or maybe as early as July, August, you could begin to talk about what was already a fact of life on the ground for 2 years if you're a professional economist. So there was this funny place, at least with Wall Street and a lot of punditry, where you could privately be one of those guys who was saying the housing market was done in 2005, and I was, and you would be subject to massive official ridicule, okay? But then privately, people started to warm up to the idea, I would say early 2006, and then they told the general public when it was way too late. In late 2007, mid-2007, let's say July, given the benefit of the doubt, half of the year over But it was already problematic. We were already seeing massively rising delinquencies, late payments, all the warning signs that anybody who really got into their intro macro econ course would have been able to identify as a bill coming due for a big party, which they're going to clean up but didn't get to go drink at.
Now, our friends down on the street at Goldman Sachs, of course, were betting against the mortgage market while they were still selling the securities to their clients.
Yeah, we'll see how long it's going to be lauded by them that they sold some of the worst crap subprime bundled mortgages on the street and made a lot of money on it. I mean, I understand they did well and that was good, and it's always good to be hedged and it's a sign of good strategy and professionalism. But there's the other side, which is you're still selling a defective product and you're confident enough in it to take huge bets against it so that you do okay in the downslide.
So who's to blame for this mess? I mean, we've got we should make a list of the people who are suffering from this problem. It's kind of tempting at this point to make fun of human folly.
Sure.
But on the other hand, there are some people who are like at the verge of losing their houses or may have already done so. A lot of people who are very seriously in debt for houses that are falling in value. And then there are broader economic fallout that could be a recession of some severity about to take hold. So many millions of people are going to be hurt by this. So,
absolutely.
Who are the guilty parties?
Have already been hurt. I mean, half of the total outstanding housing debt in the United States was written since 2002. So this is unbelievably widespread. We wrote $5 trillion in U.S. mortgage debt in the last 6 years. So the challenge would be to find any large group or area that wasn't adversely affected by this. So, I mean, I absolutely agree. I don't think it could possibly be overstated that tens of millions of American families occupy housing, which they owe as much or more than it's worth and likely to be worth for many years. And that housing was a huge boon to people. They used their houses like ATMs. They kept the economy up for 2 or 3 years. And that house, which was a positive increment to consumption and allowed families to survive and make ends meet, is about to run in reverse. It's about to turn in from a piggy bank to a huge anvil around their neck. So it would be impossible to overstate how widespread and how dangerous this is. I'd say at fault is a whole system here, which I would refer to, which is the technical term that's preferred in the industry sometimes, as originate to distribute lending. So gone are the old days, and the public is clearly not aware of this, where the people who loan money take the ride. They're in bed, so to speak, financially with the people they're loaning money to. And we moved from originate to own. So you make a loan and you're success or failure is a success or failure of the person you extended credit to.
The old days of Jimmy Stewart at the savings and loan, they make the loan and they hold it forever, right?
The only thing about that film that might be coming back as it did at Northern Rock in England is the run on the bank scene in that movie. But yeah, basically the bank sells the debt as soon as it issues it. In some cases, it's a matter of hours. And so the bank really doesn't have an interest in making sure that much that the individual in question is creditworthy. And also, you know, in a country that doesn't pay rising wages for 30 years and doesn't give a lot of benefits and doesn't create a lot of hope, everybody wants a get-rich-quick scheme. Everybody wants to cash in on the dream, which is fading. And if you give people credit, they'll take it. So, I mean, it's hard to apportion blame, but they gave a lot of credit to people who historically didn't give credit, get credit extended to them, and the people took the credit. And it was an apple. It looked great and shiny, but there was a razor blade in the middle of it. And that razor blade were the terms, the adjustable rates, the prepayment penalties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And what about a guy who has what I think is an undeservedly high reputation, Alan Greenspan? How would he look in the lineup?
Well, I mean, I think that his famous reassurance to the public in 2003 about how wonderful adjustable rate mortgages are and how they're such a great idea, right at the time when fixed interest rates had probably reached or were approximately reaching an all-time low, will not be judged well. Because pushing large segments of the public into adjustable rate mortgages, which rise and fall with the interest rate, when you've cut interest rates to a 40-year low, begs a certain amount of questions, because really the reason those people were pushed into those mortgages is because they couldn't afford the payments unless they were an adjustable rate teaser intro. And so their long-term pain pushed up housing values and allowed other people to make speculative profits and get out of the market. So they basically took one for the team. And I think since Alan presided over the first 2 to 3 years of that bubble and the cutting that enabled that bubble, I think Alan is rightly worried, and that's part of the reason that we hear from him more often and see him more now that he's retired than we did when he was a chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. I'm sure Ben Bernanke is not happy that Alan's on TV four times for every time he is and is mostly saying, it's not my fault, it's not my fault, it's not my fault. I hope Ben does a good job. I hope Ben does a good job. Ben was handed a bag. It's on fire, and what's in it I can't mention on the radio.
Okay. But this sort of touches on my next question. You know, the Federal Reserve is one of our principal banking financial system regulators. They're supposed to look at what's going on and intervene if things are going bad, prevent things from going from bad to worse. Where were the regulators? Where was the government? Where are the people in the press and all this too?
Well, they were pretty much cheerleading this with this idea that the private sector could do a better, more innovative job with a lesser, lighter hand of regulation. That originate to distribute was a good idea, that ratings agencies and market pricing efficiencies would guarantee us that financial products and risk would be better and more efficiently allocated by the profit motive in private industry and speculative activity than it could ever possibly be done by regulator. You know, the standard private markets outperform regulators argument. And they were cheerleading this or passing through the revolving door that now pretty much defines the movement back and forth between senior corporate and governmental leadership in the United States. So they're kind of in and out of the private sector and advocates of it. And I would say one of the few people outside of the official core would have been Ben Bernanke, who was busy telling everyone that bad monetary policy intervention created the Great Depression, that there was no global imbalance, and that private markets would be great at solving this problem. And those particular follies, he was punished by being the head of the Federal Reserve Bank.
And now he's holding that that smelly burning bag, right?
Yeah, it would appear so. I doubt that. However, and I do believe you're correct there, however much Greenspan is a bit tarnished by this, and I agree with you 100%, I still think he'll be remembered more fondly than Ben. I mean, I think Ben's going to have a tougher legacy. I don't think anyone's going to write a book about him called Maestro, if I had to guess.
Yeah, well, a lot of people got rich under Greenspan's reign. Well, it doesn't seem that's happening under Bernanke's. I'm speaking with Max Frodwolf, who is an economist and a prolific journalist and writer. So where are we now? I mean, we've seen – well, you have a piece in the Huffington Post about this some very serious pain going on in a lot of municipalities in Florida because of this. Tell us about that. This is the classic Wall Street hitting Main Street story.
Sure. I mean, part of what we've been celebrating for 25 years and particularly for 6 years is the idea of deregulation and integration both globally and domestically in private markets for assets and things in general to let the market decide. And that has its advantages, but it has its disadvantages. And one of the clearest ones is contagion. And so we had this giant market, this housing market, and it really inflated out of control. And now it's hitting the wall equally out of control. And part of the reason people were shocked is kind of they expect this government regulation. So as soon as the boom gives way to bust, everyone's like, oh, where's the government? Where's the government? Where's the government? And unfortunately, the government is implicated, but it's also affected. And one little way that it's affected is the same corporations that insure municipal bonds, which are the way that states, municipalities borrow money to do things like build airports and schools and sewer systems and shopping malls, which they're not supposed to but often do, and roads and all the rest. The same agencies that insure government bonds also insured a lot of mortgage product, MBIA, AmBank, a whole bunch of large ones, and they're basically broke now. I know they're saying they're not. They still have some capital, but they have insured so many mortgages that will probably not be paid back that their future as an ongoing series of concerns is now in question. And you don't have to take my word for it because while everyone kind of denies the dire situation for these insurers, a guy who most people don't think is a fool named Warren Buffett announced recently that he's starting his own competitor municipal bond insurance company because he realized this is a lucrative game and the dominant players are all kind of in a lot of trouble. So I mean, he thinks so too. It's not just me. But the idea being that this bond insurance that was these companies provided to municipalities as well as home mortgages allowed lots of municipalities to borrow more money on better terms. So if they lose the ability to get their municipal bonds insured and therefore to guarantee AAA and the best possible terms for their borrowing, you're going to see a funny situation, which is not funny at all, in which in a recession when there's higher demands on services from local and state agencies who also face lower tax returns because they've been making a fortune in the housing boom and they're counting on an economic boom that becomes an economic bust, at the self-same moment, it's going to be harder for them to borrow to make up their tax shortfalls and they're going to spend more money for those loans when they can get them. So it's a nice example of how the housing downturn has metastasized or spread out of an area that you normally consider housing into an area you consider unrelated for in this case, municipal bonds, or the teacher's retirement pension fund in Florida, to which you allude to, or even the town pension fund in remote little towns in Norway, which were, you know, famously slammed in Rana, Norway, which no one really thought of as much dependent on U.S. subprime borrowing.
What about other possibilities for trouble? I mean, some people have been talking about the commercial real estate market, all the office buildings that went up in recent years. Are we going to see a rerun of what's happened in housing there?
I think we'll see a small – it wasn't quite the same bubble, and it was probably more professionally managed because less retail investors, less small independent investors, and more big institutional investors who tend to have teams of people who strive to take care of them.
Oh, a lot of those guys haven't looked so smart lately either.
No, they haven't. But you presume they can pass the pain down the line a little bit. But yeah, absolutely. I think there'll be a smaller repeat. I think there's lots of other big areas. About a third of all new job creation since 2001 is housing or housing related. An awful lot of America works in retail. And all this housing boom and the cheap available credit really meant that Americans could spend a lot, and including a lot more than they could afford. And so whole vast swaths of the shopping mall center, the retail stores, employment, all kinds of personal services and all kinds of construction and retail and construction and retail related jobs are going to go up in smoke in the next 18 months. And that's going to be a lot of economic hardship, a lot of lost employment. And I might add a lot of lost employment for groups in the population working in retail and construction that don't always have a million other great employment opportunities to transition immediately into. So the pain is there. And this is going to take place in the context of lots of people who artificially, through credit creation, moved from renters to owners, being forced back into being renters or being kept as owners. And the only thing I'd say here, which is controversial, is there's a whole lot of people who they might try to, quote, help, end quote, stay in their house, who would actually be better off leaving their house. Because spending the next 30 years overpaying for a house at high interest rates that will not be worth as much as you paid for another 10 years sounds great. So Santa can visit you in a property that you technically own, but financially may not be the best for you. It might be better for the bank, but it might not be better for you. And I realize that's a crazy thing to say. You're not going to hear anyone else say that on the radio, but it is something that constantly occurs to me, and a show like yours has the courage to be a format where you can say something like that.
We welcome that sort of thing. What about, I mean, you kind of alluded to this, the kinds of jobs we've created in this country, among the leading sectors in the last 5 years have been bars and restaurants, healthcare, which is important, but I don't know. Is that really the source of value creation in the economy? I don't know. Retail and residential construction. So is an economy based on these kinds of sectors really healthy in the long term?
I mean, it depends on how you do it. I would agree. I don't know how healthy that economy is. I think we've built what we call a service economy that I would call a servant economy. And the servant economy needs people with a lot of extra money who want all kinds of personal services. So if you look at some of the fastest growing classifications, you know, there are things like being a personal bodyguard or a masseuse, which is a servant as much as a service. And we've done a lot of things in this country that really involve consumption, because 70% of the economy is consumption. And if we've been over-consuming based on debt and housing bubble, and we're going to have to consume a whole lot less, then those things are perilous. And I also would 100% agree that we've been spending a lot of money, for instance, on healthcare services, which always shows up as a leading growth area in employment. But our healthcare results stink. 37th in the world is not much to be proud of. And that you have a lot of people who have health care in this country because they borrow money to pay for health insurance, or do they get it through work? So if you have people with limited access to debt and a difficult employment situation, then the basis of paying these folks in the health care system might be a bit wobbly. And we also have, you know, we're not basically producing hyper-competitive manufacturing and service jobs that will allow us to be globe-leading in key sectors. Instead, we're doing other things in the servant economy. And I think I would agree with you 100% that those are less sustainable and less long-term exciting for the position of the United States in the global economy.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but let's talk about that the international situation, which is that the United States has borrowed enormous amounts of money. It started really in the early 80s, but really accelerated with around 2000, 2001, financed the whole mortgage boom, mostly from abroad. We now have foreign debts equal to what, 30-35% of GDP. We're really up to our ears in it. What will the consequences be of this, do you think?
I'm not sure anyone knows, but it's created a global fragility to America's financial situation, the likes of which the world hasn't seen. A quick number I like to discuss with my students over at the New School, where I teach some classes in the GPIA there, is that about as much borrowing from the rest of the world was done from the time they signed the Constitution to the inauguration of President Bush as he's managed to do in the last 7 years. Pretty much doubled what we had borrowed in the previous couple centuries of our existence. That's no minor matter. As you said perfectly correctly, in the mid-1980s, about 86, 87, the United States went from being a net creditor, we loaned to the world net, to a net borrower. Now we've net borrowed about $2.6 trillion from the rest of the world, or our economy is running on between $2 and $3 billion per day in net borrowing from the rest of the world. We've been borrowing a lot from oil exporters in East Asia, meaning that our pain is their pain. And in some level, our sheer size of our debt kind of begs the old story that if you loan me $10 and I can't pay you back, it's too bad for me. But if you loan me $10 billion and I can't pay you back, it's too bad for you. Right, so the rest of the world is a little dependent on us. And kind of what we've seen is they're throwing money at us because they're nervous about how dangerous our situation is. And a significant amount of the Chinese purchasing of U.S. mortgage securities, the Japanese purchasing of U.S. debt, and the Middle Eastern purchasing of U.S. debt in the last few months is in fact an effort to shore up the American economy because no one knows who else they're going to ship their stuff to. Because on some level, we're a consumer plantation. You make it, we'll buy it. 4.5% of the world's population doing about 25% of the world's private consumption, it's not so easy to replace us. So everybody's nervous about how much money we've borrowed, nervous if we can pay it back, and maybe first and foremost right now, nervous about what the hell else they can do with all the stuff they're producing if they don't sell it to us, because they're definitely not paying their people enough to buy it themselves, at least not yet. And that's going to be the big question of the next 2 to 3 years for the global economy.
Well, now it just reminds us why the economics is known as the dismal science. I've been speaking with Max Frodwolf, and as he was saying that on the screen here in the studio, we have Channel 1 on, and they were reporting that the New York City housing market has been driven by the $10 million-plus apartment in the last quarter. So this is
an everyday pied-à-terre for the average working family.
For all those of you living in your $10 million apartment.
But even that's interesting. The New York real estate market has kept up while a lot of the rest of the country turned down for a very interesting reason, which is foreign buying. Because the dollar's fallen so far, so fast, that to foreign buyers who are crazy enough and out of the loop enough to think this is a great long-term investment in New York City apartment at this point, this looks cheap, and foreign money is flooding in. And, you know, as you walk around the streets of Manhattan the last couple months, it's hard not to think, even as a casual empiricist or whatever, walking around in New York, if you're an economist, maybe more, but otherwise too, New York seems like it's a place that Americans can't afford anymore, and it's full of very wealthy people from the rest of the world where the money is. And part of New York's success is at attracting them to buy our homes and eat in our restaurants and shop in our stores. And I challenge anyone in your listening area who's in the immediate Manhattan area not to notice the enormous number of people who don't seem to be U.S. nationals who are partaking of the ritziest and most expensive Manhattan has to offer.
Well, good luck to them. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and odds of the evening. I will be back next week. And let's go out with this, which is, I think, the only popular song about the Contrario wave, Ping Pong by Stereolab from their 1994 album Mars Audiac Quartet. Till next week. Just love them.